So, welcome to this session about narrative. Now, the reason I thought it would be a good idea to sort of talk about narrative is we're going to talk a lot for the rest of the day about issues around science journalism and what journalism is and all of that, whether we should be covering press releases and all these things. But this is kind of something that's a step back from all of those things. It's how to write so that the person you're writing for wants to read what you've written. And it's as simple as that, really. And it's harder than it sounds, as all of you here who've tried to write things for people will know. Many scientists don't have to worry about these things because the papers they read are often dense and dull and boring, however interesting the science, because no one has to read to the end of it. They're forced to because of the disciplines and things they're in. We're involved in a different game. We're involved in making sure that people who aren't necessarily interested in what we're writing about have to get to the end. And so the drama, the tension, the information has to be delivered in the right sort of pace, at the right level, so that people get to the end without feeling like they've read anything. Many of you know how to write really well. And so when we've finished our presentations, what I'd like to hear from you is stories about how you do your own writing. If you've got questions about problems with writing, but, you know, bring them up, because we're all sort of in the same boat. Not everyone writes brilliantly all the time, and it's good to share your angst with a sort of like-minded group of psychiatric patients that we are in this room. So on the panel today are three brilliant people who will give you three different aspects of what it's like to write longer and longer form, how to structure something so that people want to read something you've written. First to speak will be Richard Fisher, who's in the middle there. Richard Fisher is not only on Mad Men, he's one of the features editors at New Scientist. Based in London, he commissions features on technology and its implications, earth science, psychology. Before that, he was New Scientist deputy news editor, covering physics, astronomy, geology, and other physical sciences. And I think what Richard's going to hopefully give to us is, many of us who've written about news, he's going to tell you the difference between news and feature, how to go from one to the other. Next up is Tom Levinson. He's a professor of science writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. See, I managed to say that without stumbling as well. MIT. He's a professor of science writing at MIT, and he's the head of the program in writing and humanistic studies and the graduate program in science writing at that college. He's the author of four books on science and the history of science, most recently Newton and the Counterfeiter and Einstein in Berlin. He's also produced, directed, written, and executive produced more than a dozen science documentaries, most recently the PBS miniseries Origins, and the Back to the Beginning episode in that series, which was written, produced, and directed by Tom. It won the 2005 National Academies Communication Award. He's going to talk not only about constructing writing, but also he's going to give us some ideas about visual storytelling. And last but not least is Manjit Kumar at the end there, who has degrees in physics and philosophy. What a nerd. He's edited for Wired, for the science arts magazine Prometheus, not the film, and also many, many wonderful science books, including most recently Quantum, which is a gritty telling of the history of the early days of quantum mechanics. Richard, do you want to go first? And this has started to do something now that I don't understand, so I hope that you can switch that off. Your stuff is just up. Give us a few minutes for the tech.
Okay, so I'm one of the nine feature editors at New Scientist, and recently I moved from news editing to feature editing. I guess I want to make a simple point today that I think is worth saying out loud, that news and features are very different. Many writers start out their careers writing shorter pieces or blogs. They then go on to win commissions for longer narrative features, but they often apply the same rules that they learned early in their career to writing a longer piece. So I think it's a common misconception that features are simply longer, more in-depth articles about science, which isn't quite true. I think even experienced writers sometimes forget this and fail to adapt the way that they report and write a longer piece. So today I'm going to talk about some of those differences and the practical things it's important to consider when writing a narrative feature. It's worth saying before I start, I'm not disparaging news or blog writing. I was a news editor for many years, and each approach is valid. They're just different. First of all, though, I think it's worth, since I'm opening, starting with the question, what is the point of narrative storytelling in the first place? There's a quote I like from the day, storytelling is persuasive jujitsu. Basically, if you write a good story, readers won't stop reading halfway through a piece. It also, writing a good story persuades people to share stories. I mean, if you look at the growth of long reads, longform.org, the browser, and the way that people are sharing longer pieces on Twitter, to a certain extent, it's a golden age of feature writing, and people are sharing these pieces because they're great stories. And I think there is some evidence, there's some psychology studies that suggest people are more likely to be persuaded by an argument when storytelling is employed. So that's the point. I mean, it gets people, it persuades people to write, to read your piece, and it also gets it shared. However, I regularly read raw copy from non-experienced and experienced feature writers alike, and publish features in magazines that fail to employ the basic principles of narrative storytelling. So I just want to cover some of the basic differences and also the non-obvious differences between news and feature writing. I think the first point I just want to make and say out loud is that you have to report for narrative. I think many writers, when they take on a long-form piece, they fail to ask the right questions for crafting a story. The typical approach when you kind of tackle a shorter story is that you read the paper and then you just ask questions about the science and then go off, write your story, check with alternative sources, and then that, I realise that's simplification, but that if you take that approach at a longer form level, then you end up with a stitched together narrative of lots of shorter news stories. So I think the point is to ask questions for story. I mean, I haven't got time to go into detail about this, and it takes a long time to kind of work out what these questions are, but I guess some basic points. Try to avoid the interviewer and source dynamic. I mean, try and be more conversational. I think the best narrative feature writers are just generally curious. They just pepper their sources with questions that aren't about what's in the paper. They're about the background. Questions like, what first inspired you, or how did it feel when you did that? And tell me about the setbacks along the way. I mean, these are just basic questions. And I think it might seem obvious to more experienced writers, but I don't think some writers ask those questions, and therefore they don't get the answers that allow them to construct a narrative further down the line. The second point I just want to make when you're reporting is to observe telling details. I think the other panelists are going to talk about this a little bit more in more detail, but the one point I want to make is that in general, a news reporter's instinct is to comprehensively report what they see. Narrative writers tend to observe telling details that advance the story, and it sounds similar, but there is a difference. I think good narrative reporters take notes about character and scenery to build a story and not just to pad it out, and they note details that show don't tell. There's a whole world of lessons you can learn about this if you read up on how to do narrative writing, but for the purposes of this talk, I just want to share a couple of bugbears. I think misconceptions about writing in a narrative style. I think the first is pointless colour. I think this is usually like motivated by a misguided attempt to add human interest. So you get sentences like Joe had long brown hair and a beard, or the scientist's office was full of books with a picture of her son on the desk, or it was a snowy evening in Idaho. I mean, these are all kind of cliches, and also you've got to ask, do they tell the reader anything useful or interesting about the characters, their motivations, or their unique traits? And crucially, does it advance the story? If it doesn't, cut it. I'm also a big fan of economy. I think it's another misconception. If you write long, then you have to write in a flowery language. I think just because you're writing long doesn't mean that you can't be economic in your language. I mean, to summarise this, I mean, there's a Ernest Hemingway story that he once bet somebody $10 that he could write a story only 6 words long, and this is what he wrote. And it's a short story and it works, and he won the bet. So I think be brutal with your language. I mean, ask yourself, does it advance the story that you're trying to write? I have to talk about structure. It is the single biggest pitfall that you can encounter if you fail to consider structure. I mean, to generalise, the basic news story is the inverted triangle, or at least it's a fair amount of like top heaviness and front loading of the crucial information at the top of the story. Good feature writers hold back the information. At New Scientist, we call this the gap. It's just another way of saying intrigue. Basically, do enough that gets your reader, tell the reader, indicate what's coming, but don't give the game away. So don't, when you're writing your billboards and nut graphs, don't tell the whole story. It's not an abstract of a scientific paper. Another thing about structure is avoiding a list of things. Basically, a lot of people put together story. Lots of different papers, lots of different scientists, glue them together into a whole, and there's no kind of flow. I mean, just to demonstrate this, my colleague Graham Lawton came up with this. He deserves the credit. I mean, he basically uses two very simple children's books to illustrate the difference between a list of things and a story. So the first children's book is called Tractor in a Field. So you read through the story, tractor's in the field, tractor's in the barn, tractor's in the courtyard, tractor's on the road, tractor's on the hill. The end, and that's the story. It's the list of things. The second children's story he uses is called Sleepy Cat. So Sleepy Cat starts with an inciting incident. Cat is sleepy. Where can cat sleep? This drives like this. Cat is a protagonist on a quest. Can cat sleep in the garden? No, it's too cold. This is the first setback, which is something you often see in a narrative. Can cat sleep in the kitchen? No, it's too busy in there. Can cat sleep in the washing machine? No, don't be silly. Can cat sleep in his comfy bed? Yes, cat can. It's a very simple structure, but it matches something which is, depending on where you look at it, it's called the universal plot structure. I mean, so this, basically all stories involve protagonists. They involve some sort of inciting incident that prompts people to go on a quest in the first place, sometimes called the Gandalf moment. When I say sometimes call, I call it the Gandalf moment. And heading towards a goal. Hitchcock described that goal as the MacGuffin. I mean, so for example, in Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull is the MacGuffin. Indiana Jones ends up somewhere else with aliens, but that doesn't matter. What drives the plot is he's trying to track something down. And another thing is, all stories have success and setbacks. It's never smooth. I guess the question is how does that relate to science? I'll just briefly show an example. This is a story that my colleague Michael LePage wrote. It's nominated for an ABSW award tonight. This is just the intro of the story, which describes how a scientist was driving along with his kids one day, stopped at a lake and found that the sticklebacks inside the lake were not what he expected to find. And this was the kind of his call to action, his Gandalf moment, which meant he went off to go and look for more examples and eventually found out that evolution is going much faster than we thought before. Most scientists are on a quest to find something most of the time. It's a quest for discovery. And more often than not, there's usually a moment which inspires them to do it in the first place. So I think it's worth always asking just what inspired you to kind of try and find this out in the first place. I mean, sometimes it's boring. Sometimes it's a conference presentation or it's not worth adding into the story. But sometimes you get a story like that and it's your intro. Just briefly as well, I just want to, drilling down, there are other plot variants on the kind of the basic quest narrative. I mean, some people reckon there are 7 basic plots, which I won't go into in detail, but I'll give you an example of one, which kind of inspired me to write a story recently. A tragic narrative. I mean, as I say, that the most scientists are on a quest for discovery, so if it was a movie, they'd be in Lord of the Rings on a quest to find something out or to do something, but many protagonists are doing the opposite. They're on a downfall. So examples from fiction are Macbeth, The Sopranos. I mean, to a certain extent, Jade Goody followed a tragic narrative, and I think that she had lots of setbacks on the way, including Big Brother, and eventually ended in death, and I think that's probably why she sold a lot of magazines. How does that relate to science? Well, it inspired me to write a story recently which was about a guy called Maurice Ward. He was an inventor who came up with a remarkable material that could kind of resist heat and fire. And he showed it on Tomorrow's World and got a lot of interest in it from NASA and Boeing and all sorts of people. But 20 years later, he died without ever commercializing it. So basically the story was his downfall, how he went from having this amazing material that could have changed the world to dying in obscurity. So, just to summarise, very simple point. News and features might seem similar because they draw from the same well of scientific source material, but to do each one best, I think journalists must remember to change their writing style from the moment they pick up the phone through to the moment they put the pen to paper. Okay, thank you.
I need to mic up. Be mic'd or something. Fall into this great hole in the middle of the floor. That would be most embarrassing. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Alok, for putting this together. And I believe Ed Young was also the producer. Thank you. Well, I told Alok I could talk about structure, but we always talk about structure, and could I talk about some other things? And he very kindly said yes. So in service of writing long form, I want to talk about some of the elements, other elements that you use within structure to make the whole thing go. And the three things I'm going to talk about in the formal part of the presentation, we can go anywhere you want during the Q&A, of course, are character, scene, and meaning. And just to dive right in, rather. You know, what you always want, as Richard said, is for the elements of your story, whatever they may be, to unfold in a way that readers cannot stop reading. And that's why we always talk, that is in fact why we always talk about structure, because that's the point. You want to have something that ends your paragraph that actually leads you to make the move to the next paragraph. And you really want to have a structural idea that works on every level, so that at every, you know, meaningful unit of the story, you still have some reason to keep reading. But the emotional core of the connection you need to form with your reader comes from caring about the consequences of the story for someone. And that someone is character, a character or a number of characters. And there's lots to be said about the creation and use of the idea of character in science writing. But here I'm just going to highlight a couple things. First, as Richard said, the pitfall in thinking about character, particularly when you are making this transition from writing more on-the-moment news stories to these longer-form works, is this preoccupation that we have with humanizing the scientists. It actually is relevant. I saw a tweet from one of the other sessions than the one I was sitting in, talking about how we don't cover science, we cover scientists. Well, yes-ish. I remember years and years ago a big high-budget television series in the United States, I don't know if it's shown over here, called The Astronomers, which in the first episode, it shows this astronomer who is divorced, male astronomer, fixing breakfast for his kid, and the narrator and the interviewee made the point that, you know, look, I've got a son, I'm divorced, I have to do this, and this is just, look, I put my trousers on, you know, one leg at a time, just like everybody else, and I've got a memo for everyone. Nobody cares, you know, doesn't advance the story, fine. In science writing, and generally in any good writing, of course, the use of character is supposed to serve a particular end, and that is to make the work being discussed, whatever it is, whether it's a relationship in a novel or, you know, a political dispute or whatever, it's to make the work being discussed consequential to both the figure on the page You're imbuing the character with personality and individuality and all that, and to the one holding the e-reader. So, to give an example of the kinds of humanizing moments that advance the cause of the piece as opposed to appear to describe or you know, give sort of an external view. You know, I guess that's the real point. You want to be inside your character when you're writing about your character. You don't want to be external to them. Let me give you a very brief example from the Origins film that Alok kindly mentioned, Back to the Beginning, in which Robert Penzias, or Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson are receiving the Nobel Prize for their observation of the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Their serendipitous discovery was so important, it won Penzias and Wilson the Nobel Prize.
The actual ceremony in Stockholm was kind of a blur. I never had quite gotten over the feeling of not being a grown-up, that other people are older, smarter, and so forth, and that I don't think that ever leaves.
When the Nobel Prize was announced, I think probably one of the first things I thought about was, do I really deserve this? And should my name be on the same list with Einstein? It just seemed completely wrong. Over the years, I guess, I've come to understand that the Nobel Prize is given for discovering something, not for being the smartest person around. So while there are much smarter people around, we did something significant, and I feel comfortable with it now.
So there's no information that's useful to the core of the science story there. But there is, but we're not talking about the color of Robert Wilson's eyes either. And just to, again, pick up on what Richard said, it took an hour of a very carefully planned interview to get to the point where these two very proud and in Arno's case, very prickly men to be willing to speak with that kind of honesty. I mean, I was actually very surprised that Arno said what he did. And, you know, it does serve the story, though. Even though it's not about the cosmic microwave background radiation, it says two things. One, that the discovery was a big deal. You know, Wilson says, I realize I got it because the Nobel Prize is rewarded for things like this. So that helps the audience understand why this is important. And it says something very important about the process of science, and it gives you a kind of human connection with these people that's integral to what you've been hearing for the previous 10, 15 minutes of the film. And that is that science is very difficult and it's very challenging and it involves emotion and passion and as you saw in, as you would have seen earlier in the film, luck. And when something great happens, it changes you. And hopefully that came through in just that little clip. That's what you want when you build character. You want something that gives insight into, gives you some interpretative frame for the information you're providing and some human connection between the actors in your story and the people reading. So we can obviously talk a lot more about different ways to think about character and build character, but because Alok has been an extraordinary taskmaster on the matter of keeping to time, let me jump to scene. Now, characters do things, and they do them in actual places. And that combination of action and location frames what we recognize in the movies as a scene. And you need scenes in your writing, too, if you're going to go long form. You know, it's not just a sequence of information. And even if your story is primarily an argument, I mean, if you're writing an essay about something, even the ideas take place in some kinds of virtual spaces. And I'm going to show you this in just a moment in the video clip. And when you start to write, particularly, you know, Richard was talking about features. I'm really thinking more in this talk about working towards significantly longer form works. The you know, Kindle singles, TED books, Atavist, 20,000-word type pieces, and books. But it's true in features, too. It's absolutely true in features. So setting out to create scenes is one of the keys to keeping interest and to develop the larger significance of what you're doing. And again, what Richard's already emphasized, making a scene does not simply mean writing physical description. The description is the tool you use to do at least one of two things, preferably both, and that's advance the action and provide insight into what? Not just the information, the characters that you've placed in the scene. So let's consider one sentence from the first page of Daniel Deronda. She was bending and speaking English to a middle-aged lady seated at play beside her. But the next instant, she returned to her play and showed the full height of a graceful figure, with a face which might possibly be looked at without admiration, but could hardly be passed with indifference. I wrote a blog post about this for the blog Balloon Juice a few months, just looking at that one sentence as a remarkable piece of writing. And one of the things to notice in this context is it is a scene. I mean, perhaps the least quantum of a scene, but it is. You have an action that has a consequence that draws Deronda's and the audience's attention to something about this one particular woman. Every detail in that sentence is in the service of the actual point of that micro scene. Gwendolyn is a person who might not be admirable, but cannot be ignored. And Eliot gets an enormous amount of physical location without a great deal of actual word-by-word description. You have an implied room. You have a sense of the table. She's, you know, there's someplace there at play. She never says the word table. There's a social setting. And there's actually even a delineation of physical space in that movement from the diagonal leaning over the person to the upright. And then there is an interpretation of character. You don't actually, she doesn't say Gwendolyn has brown eyes or she's got, you know, a big breast or whatever. She conveys Gwendolyn's ambiguous character all without mention of the drapes or anything else or what the chair looks like. It's all there. And you have an image in your head of a place, a person, and a movement that has some meaning in the story. So let's see how this might work out for science journalism. Let me see if I can get to the point. Let me see, I have to go to 3927. This is a slightly long clip, and I may cut it off because we do want to keep moving. But I'll try and give you just enough to see something of what's going on. 3927, all right. Scooch, all right, well, that'll do. Yeah, shut up, Neil. That's Neil deGrasse Tyson, a wonderful performer.
The atoms in the universe heavier than hydrogen and helium are forged by stars.
Stars are really interesting. They don't just sit there, you know, because they last so much longer than we do. We think they're permanent.
Stars are the ultimate alchemists. They turn light elements into heavier ones. They get the energy that they need to glow that way. A star begins its life made out of hydrogen and helium mostly, about 70% hydrogen, 28% helium in the case of the sun.
In a star's core, the temperature and pressure are so high that hydrogen atoms fuse together to make helium. Hydrogen fusion releases prodigious amounts of energy, the heat and light of a star.
That's the story for 90% of the light of a star, fusing hydrogen to make helium.
But eventually, though, the star runs out of hydrogen and begins to fuse its stocks of helium, making yet heavier elements.
And so the way it works, and it always works this way, is that it contracts and it gets hotter. And if it can find something new to burn, whether it's the kitchen sink or coal or whatever, it'll burn it.
Helium is taken three at a time to make carbon.
You can add one more helium to that carbon and make element number 8, oxygen.
That's a tremendous step forward. You get carbon and nitrogen and oxygen made in stars.
Now this is great because on the board we already have the principal elements of life.
Organic chemistry is the chemistry of carbon.
All right, it goes on, and then we blow up a supernova, and then we make the elements heavier than iron, and it's great. We get all the stuff we need to be. But, you know, think about that as a constructed scene. There's a stylized place. There's action set up as a game. There's this interplay between the two of them. And just to flip back to the concept of character, one thing to note in science writing is not all your characters are human. Nature is, if not usually, the protagonist, the antagonist in exactly the kind of quests that Richard was talking about. And you can, without anthropomorphizing nature, make nature an active player in the way you write the story. You know, the star is doing things. It goes harder. It gets, you know, it gets denser and hotter, and it burns anything it can find, and so forth and so on. You know, nature is a much, it's not just sitting there in this scene. Now, notice, we didn't have to do any of this. What we're actually saying is fusion fuses light elements into heavy elements, and a star does that enough to produce all the elements of the periodic table, and that's how we get the elements, you know, from the early universe, which I said hydrogen, helium, and a little bit of lithium. That's how we get to where we are today with the elements that form our bodies and everything else. Get it done in 30 seconds. I spent 5 minutes on this in the film, 4.5 minutes. And the moral in all that is even when you have just straight data, a bit of information you want to get across to the audience, in the long form, where you want people to keep reading, think about how to frame that information as dynamic element of story, and to do so you have to put it in a scene and have the scene unfold, have something change over the course of that scene and change with consequences that you then go on to play out in the next scene, and the next scene until you have a sequence, an act, and a whole work. So that's the moral. Look for ways to embed information in sequences of action where the outcome of what's being done has real consequences. So finally, let's go to my last clip, and I want to talk about why you need to always be thinking about meaning when you're doing this. Now, it sounds obvious, but it's actually sometimes hard to remember when you're in the thick of writing a long-form piece. You have all this information, and you know it's important, and you're interested in it, and you've worked hard to get it, but it actually has to mean something as well as tell you something. And let me just play you the end of this film, and you can see what all the information in this film and all the sequences of it we're actually setting out to do, and we're doing implicitly throughout the 50 minutes that preceded the clip you're about to see.
Our universe is hospitable to life. There are billions and billions of galaxies everywhere, cooking elements, making stars that are right for solar systems. The habitat for life is everywhere.
That's no proof that life itself exists anywhere else in the universe. But Sandy's work does confirm that the elements essential to life as we know it are widespread throughout the cosmos.
The message of the deep survey and all the other information that we're getting is one beautiful story, a new version of Genesis, a new version of the cosmic myth. Only this time it's scientifically based, from the Big Bang to now. Big Bang, formation of galaxies, formation of heavy elements and supernova, sun, earth, life. One unbroken great chain of being.
Just in the last few years, we've reached the point that we can start with the origins of the universe, we can end with a conversation among intelligent beings about how things work, and have an awfully good understanding of every step that came in between the two.
It is as if we're basically assembling this puzzle, and all of a sudden we look down at the puzzle and you realize you've got it. The pieces are there.
For almost all of human history, the heavens have been beyond our reach. For our ancestors, it was a place where the gods lived, or else simply a vast, untouchable realm of lifeless beauty. Now, the study of cosmic origins tells a different story. It tells us that the story of life, of us, extends far beyond Earth. It tells us that the emergence of the conditions for our kind of life was no accident. Instead, it was a natural outcome of almost 14 billion years of cosmic evolution.
It goes on a little bit more in the same vein. I wanted to run it through to the word evolution, in part because that was the only time in the film that word occurred. But of course, the whole film was about that, and it was an attempt to construct a framework for the audience to understand that the naturalistic explanation for the origin and development of a habitable universe were completely in place. And, by the way, I always enjoyed the cheesiness of the music there. That was a deliberate choice. And I think a little cheerleading for the power of science is never amiss. But the point is that this film was always about something else in addition to what it was telling you. And good stories, this means, as you think about writing long form, good stories have to work at the level of plot. You have to have a specific story to tell where people do things and things happen because of them. But if you're going to actually, ask somebody to give you N hours of their time to pay attention to what you have said, you have both a pragmatic desire and an obligation, I think, to give them something more than that. And that something more is meaning, and it means you need to look in your story for that larger sense of what your story thematically addresses as well as the sequence of events. That's probably about it. I've got some practical tips, but if you want them, you'll Great. Ask for them later.
Right.
There we go.
I'm getting mic'd up there, if you can whatever. Good look at that.
Identify
picture.
All those people.
That's right.
Is that the challenge? See how many you can get. That wasn't taken yesterday.
1927.
But you're not allowed to do it.
I know.
I'm really pleased to be here and take part in this discussion. I hope to just sort of complement what Tom and Richard have said. They've been, you know, talking a little bit more broadly about you know, things like structure and narrative. I was asked to have a look and talk about my book Quantum. Now, there are loads and loads of books about quantum physics, you know, and. And the question, one of the questions I had to ask myself was, was there a need for another one? You know, was there room for another one? And obviously I thought yes, because I went on to write this book. But I wanted to explain how I came about writing my book, Quantum, and the subtitle of which is Einstein, Bohr, and the Great Debate About the Nature of Reality. What inspired me to write the book was this picture. It's taken in 1927. What looks like a wet Monday morning. And I saw that, first time I saw that was 30 years ago, in a biography of Einstein's. And I started looking at that, and how do you get to the next day? One of those buttons. Now, what, you know, when I looked at that picture, what do you find there? You see Einstein in the front row, you've got Max Planck, you've got people that, you know, household names really, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Dirac, Bohr. And to me, it was a great cast of characters. Now, we've heard, you know, Tom just, you know, people have mentioned character. And to me, it looked like it was like a veritable who's who of 20th century physics. And when I looked at that, I thought, well, that would be a great in to talk about quantum physics. You know, what were they doing there in October 1927? What did they talk about? Now, I was interested in specifically in a debate between Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr about the interpretation of quantum mechanics. What did quantum mechanics mean? It was something that wasn't really discussed much when I was at college. You know, you got to learn the mathematics and the mechanics of quantum physics, but not the debate that had sort of gone on in the 1920s and the 30s and the 40s between some of these you know, pioneers of quantum mechanics. So when, the more I looked at that picture, the more I thought, you know what, that's that will be a good way to tell the story. The focus of my book is the debate between Einstein and Bohr. So Tom and Richard have both mentioned structure. So I had to think, you know, how do I structure my book? I could have started with this conference in 1927, had a little maybe chapter on quantum physics, the ideas of quantum physics, and then just gone forward. I thought that's one way of doing it, but the way I chose to do it, the way I thought it was interesting and make it accessible to the reader was to start with this conference, introduce all these people that you see there, people like Planck, who discovered the quantum in 1900, Einstein, who made the next revolutionary leap in quantum physics by coming up with the idea of a quantum theory of light, introduce these characters and their contributions and come back to the conference. So start with the conference, try and get the reader interested in, you know, this is where we want to try and end up, and the debate between these two people, Einstein and Bohr, but introduce the physics and the characters and the work that they did in the context in which they did it. And so I, later on when I was talking to somebody about this, they said, oh, Manju, what you've done is you've adopted a knee structure. You've started here, which is the conference, you want to get back to the conference, and then you want to take it forward. I didn't know that I'd done that. It was just a, you know, a lucky thing for me. But once I had decided upon what I wanted to try and do with Planck, Einstein, Bohr, introduce each of these characters, introduce the contributions that they made and get it to the conference. The scope of the book also, you know, becomes clear, because if I'd started in 1927 and I'd had a little preamble about quantum ideas up until that point, then I would have gone on until about the 55, when Einstein died in 1955, Bohr died in 1962. But because I was going to seriously take the reader from this conference in the sort of prologue and spend half the book getting back to the conference, introducing these characters. And for me, the characters were great. I had to sort of marry ideas, character, and the context in which the science was being done. So it also meant that the scope was from the late 19th century all the way into the 1960s, instead of maybe from the mid-20s to Einstein's death. And so the structure sort of determined the scope of the book. And the scope of the book also helped determine the research I had to do. Because I had to look at the... there's some pictures up here I wanted to show. When I talk about... I also saw this picture. And it looks like Boris chasing Einstein down the street there. Einstein seems happy, Boris seems a bit anxious. And there's another picture of those two in the 1930s. It's one of a series of pictures when they're chatting. Now, all of those sort of things, I wanted to try and convey, if you like, the nature of the debate between Einstein and Bohr and the other participants, people like Heisenberg and Schrödinger. So I also wanted to give a sense of, you know, how come the quantum? We all know about quantum physics. You know, what is the quantum? I wanted to give a sense of how the quantum was discovered. And what I found was quite interesting, that the quantum was discovered in 1900 partly because the Germans wanted to make better light bulbs, right? So my book became sort of a marriage of science and history and the participants who were making the physics. The reason the Germans wanted to make a better light bulb is that Germany was formed in the 1870s. And at the time, we might have the internet information technology now, but in the 1870s, the industry that everybody was working in was electricity, you know. And there weren't even, you know, ways of standardising the measurement for luminosity and things like that. And the leading players were the British and the Americans and the Germans, new players on the world sort of stage, wanted to sort of push German industry. And one of the things that they thought they, you know, really needed to do was to catch up with the British and the Americans when it came to making better light bulbs. And so it was experiments that were being done technically it was called black body radiation. It was you've got ovens, if you like high-tech ovens, and you try to measure the radiation in these high-tech ovens. And Planck came up with a formula, and in that formula matched the curves that were being generated when they were measuring these radiation in these high-tech ovens. And he came up with the quantum to try and explain the nature of these curves. And the nature of those, the reason they were doing these experiments, because they wanted to have a benchmark to calibrate light bulbs. So, there were loads of interesting things like that I discovered in the course of the research. And the question becomes what to include and what not to include. Because the reader never knows, right? The reader never knows what you haven't included. But in a sense, it was, you know, my job or the job of the writer to actually know a lot more than what's included. I'll give you an example. I was sort of struck that... is it that one? No, this one. That one. I was struck. I mean, one of the things that struck me when I was writing the book was... how many of them were Jewish? How many of them were in their 20s, people like Heisenberg and Wolfgang Pauli? So I became very interested in what was the culture in Central Europe that gave rise to these young men entering physics. So I spent a lot of time, far more time than I should have done, looking at, say, Jewish history in the 19th century, all as a backdrop to the book that I wanted to write. So for me, you know, this picture was the inspiration to write my book. It also, because I wanted to focus on Einstein and Bohr, and some of these other characters that were pivotal to the development of quantum physics, gave me the structure of the book that I wanted to write. It also defined the period that I wanted to look at from the late 19th century to effectively the 1960s, and it also framed the amount of research that I had to do. And in fact, I ended up doing more than I really wanted to do, because I wanted to make sure that, for example, I knew the context in which the quantum was born, so that I could better explain it. Because one of the things I found you've got to do with a book like this, mine on quantum physics, is that actually you've got to give the reader a break. You know, because it's not an ideas book. A friend of mine, Marcus Chown, wrote a wonderful book called Quantum Theory Cannot Hurt You. It's not a narrative. It's just, you know, the weirdness of quantum ideas. And there are many books like that. And if you buy a book like that, then you're trying to get to grips with the weirdness of quantum physics, for example. Mine was a story. Yeah, I want to get, you know, we talked about character. Scene, Tom mentioned scene. My scene was a conference in 1927. That's where I wanted to get people to. And the debate. And I wanted them to care about the debate, about the nature of reality, and about the people who were engaged in that debate. And I had to sort of pace it as well. I had to, you know, we talked about beards. I think somebody mentioned beards. Don't mention beards and what people eat and what they look like. But one of the things that I described Boltzmann in my book, for example, in a little sketch, you know, possessed the great 19th century beard. And all of a sudden, you know, you can get to these sorts of images because my book's full of a lot of little portraits of a lot of, you know, the participants of, in the quantum revolution. I had to incorporate history, and there were times when I was thinking I was writing a history book, right, as opposed to a science book, because there is science in there. But because I don't want people to care about the characters, I want them, because I discovered when talking to people while I was writing the book, that not everybody's read a book about Einstein. You know, they know the classic image that comes to mind, the man with the white hair poking his tongue out. But what about the younger man, you know, struggling to raise his kids in the Burn Patton, you know, when he was working at the Burn Patton office? Bohr may be known to people who study physics, but it's not known to a you know, sort of your average science reader. So I wanted to try and sort of give enough information in the book about the characters, about how they got where they got, and in the and in the period in which they were doing physics, because people do science. As Tom's showing in the films there, with the clip of the chap who won the Nobel Prize for cosmic microwave background radiation. Fascinating clip to think that it took him so long to reconcile himself to that. But I also had another thing, which was that Einstein, by the 1950s and the 1940s, this giant of modern physics, had been isolated. Now, I'd read that, you know, the physics had moved on, he was isolated, he was still working in quantum physics or his unified field theory, things like that. I wanted to sort of place him within the wider sort of context of what was going on, but make people understand why he also went to do what he went on to do. Because he once said, you know, I think I've earned the right to make my mistakes. And by the time he's making those mistakes, I want people to understand that, in fact, actually, somebody who was, you know, quantum physics had moved on, he just got it wrong. I wanted to show this chap was very pivotal to the development of quantum physics. You know, he was... He developed a quantum theory of light. He'd been a conduit for various ideas, and if you look at Schrödinger, Erwin Schrödinger's development of wave mechanics, that was inspired by a footnote from Einstein's work. So I wanted to give a sense of the interactions between people, you know, between how sort of Schrödinger had inspired Einstein, had inspired Schrödinger. You know, there are various choices for me to make there, but I also, you know, I wanted to include enough science, enough about the people, to try and encourage people to turn the page. And this is why pacing became quite important to me. But like I say, you know, I did vast quantities of research, partly so I'd know what to exclude, you know. This is much more the case in a book-length project as opposed to a feature article. If you've got 2,500 words or 3,000 words, then you still have to make those choices, but on a smaller scale, about what you want to include. One of the things that I realised when I was writing the book, and as I got nearer the end of the book, I began to realise that I couldn't make anybody buy it. I couldn't make anybody read it. I couldn't make anybody review it. And so therefore I decided to write the book that I wanted to write. You know, and I wanted to incorporate all these different elements. Despite saying that, I did hope that one day somebody would read it. So I tried to bear the reader in mind, and I wanted to take that reader along with me from this conference back to that debate with those people who took part in it. And whether I succeeded or not, I don't know. It depends upon the individual person who, you know, has read that book. But like I say, write the book that you want to write, if those of you who want to write a book. But remember that hopefully it's going to be read by a reader, so bear them in mind. Thank you.
Hang on. What do we need to do? Just
while that's happening, we're going to have some time for questions. We started a little bit late, so if you don't mind, we probably will run a little tiny bit later into the lunch, but hopefully not too much. And if you need to go, please do head out. Is there a microphone in the room, or do you just need to... There is, yes. So, some questions and some short answers from our panel.
Yes.
Yes, go for it, yeah. Yes. Do you want to give this to them to talk?
Yes. Yep. I don't know who's best to answer. It might be that Alok's the person with the answer to this one.
Okay, go on.
So I haven't done any real science writing myself, but I do a lot of science broadcasting. And I sometimes find that when I interview someone, I then I do the interview and I think, ooh, that could make a really good article. But I have no idea how to go about starting that whole narrative process. So what are the links between... how you prepare, for example, for an interview, which is why I know Alok is involved in both, with the podcasting and the writing. How do you, if you did find a topic that suited both, what are the differences in the way that you prepare for the two?
I can answer that, but I think Tom might have some view on this, in terms of how you interview for broadcast and how you interview for writing. Tom's done both.
We actually discussed this at some length in the MIT Science Writing course. The critical thing for broadcast, of course, is by the time you actually have the cameras rolling or the microphone on for the radio, you really want to have a strong sense of what you're on about. You're constrained, and you also don't want to go back to the edit room with a mountain of stuff. But I feel very strongly it's the pre-interviewing process for, you know, really coming to understand what your story is about that you're trying to broadcast is the point at which you're also exploring the article. My students did a series of films around Rebecca Sachs's remarkable lab at MIT, where one of her postdocs was studying the neurobiology of conflict. And I made my students go back and interview Rebecca and that particular postdoc, Emile Bruneau, two or three times, and then really write a interview plan against an explicit pre-production story treatment of the film, so that they knew that they understood the full range of background material sufficiently to actually produce the film they chose to produce. And it's in that pre-process, I think, that you should be thinking if there are multiple uses of this information. And at that point, and it's just, you know, what journalists always do, if you've got, you know, you start thinking about what story this information could build, and if you have some ideas that diverge from what you think the best film will be, then you start writing notes and asking questions in that vein. It's a very much a practice-based thing. There aren't specific rules, I don't think.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that for me, a podcast interview or anything like that is a staged conversation rather than a proper journalistic interview where I would think, I want to find out everything possible from this person about something. So the conversation will duck and dive in lots of directions, whereas for any sort of broadcast stuff I've ever done, I've known pretty much what they're going to say, but been aware that they're going to say unexpected things and been on top of that too. More questions. Claire.
Hi, just a question for the whole panel, really. I think that a great explanation starts at the beginning. A great story almost never does. So could you give us some tips on how you sort of resolve the conflict or the tension between those two aims?
Richard?
Sometimes it does start at the beginning. I mean, I read recently that... It was a New Yorker writer talking about how the New Yorker does their narratives, and I'm not saying the New Yorker does narratives like New Scientist would, but he apparently said, use any structure you want, but know that I'm going to make it chronological, right? So I'm going to take it apart and put it back together. So I think there's something in starting simple first. Is that what you meant?
And sinks its hooks into you that way. And often the thing I find hardest about science writers is gripping the reader, but also weaving the information in a way that's easily digestible. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
100 nerd points for you for the first mention of Star Wars. Excellent. Manjit, please.
I had a problem when I was writing my book. How do I start it? You know, I was inspired by that picture, but how do I start it? And I started it by those two pictures of Einstein and Bohr together were taken by a guy called Paul Ehrenfest, who was a Dutch physicist. He was a friend of both. And in the run-up to the 1927 conference, one of his PhD students, you know, knocked on his door or something and inadvertently opened it before he was allowed in or something, found Ehrenfest in tears. And he asked him, you know, discovered that, in fact, he was in tears because he was going to go to this conference. He was going to tell one of the two people he really admired and really liked that he had sided with the other. And he sided with Bohr. So I start this, my book, I think the very first sort of sentence of the prologue is with Ehrenfest in tears. And I agree with you. I think it is possible to start where there's something happening to hook the reader. You know, rather than start talking about my picture, I could start with him in tears and go to the conference if you like. You know, it's possible. It's always possible.
Very briefly, this goes back, I think, to what I was saying about scene. Your very first moment in the film, obviously in a film, but in a book or a long article, is a scene. It's very specific. It's not your whole story. And the thing that you want to have come out of that is not an answer, but a question or a concern or some risk or danger to you know, just that little moment. And you know, just to bandy book starting points. When I wrote my Newton book, the very first scene was Newton meeting an informer in a pub, and that's, you know, near the end of the story, smack in the middle, no context, but it raises the question: what the hell is Isaac Newton? You know, 20-some years president of our host institution today. What's he doing hanging around in low pubs talking to jailbirds? And from thence, you can go any direction you want.
It's also worth reading Umberto Eco's book, where he looks at why Harry wrote In the Name of the Rose, as Manjit told me about the other night. A man stands by a riverbank. Why is he standing there? And from there, you get an entire story. More questions. Anyone? Yep, right at the front.
Thank you. It's quite easy to, with fiction, to pick out a few stories of examples of narrative where it's a really innovative use of narrative, say, Memento, where the story is told backwards. What's the most innovative narrative that you guys have seen recently?
Crazy narrative. Do you want to think about that?
My colleague Alan Lightman, in Einstein's Dreams, wrote what was ostensibly a novel, but was actually a series of essays about what the nature of time implied by, or you know, how Einstein arrived at his idea of a nature of time. And that's a wonderful conceit and has structural implications. I have to think for more.
I'd say, no, it's not necessarily innovative, but I'd say the narratives I'm most impressed by are the ones that speak to like some of the basic plot archetypes that you see recurring. There are a lot of stories that are essentially rags to riches tales or coming of age. So the reason that the first Matrix is better than the other two is because Neo follows a kind of he's an office drone at the beginning and then he's Neo at the end. And so I think when you see science stories that follow some of those kind of those tropes, those kind of like classic story shapes, then I think they're the ones that I think are the best. It's not necessarily the cleverest, but it's the best story.
I mean, all I would say would be that when it comes to nonfiction, you are constrained by the facts, you know, at one level. You know, I mean, Einstein was born at a certain point, he died at a certain point. The quantum, for example, in my book, was discovered at a certain period. Events unfolded at certain times and places, you know, and there's not a lot of scope to play with that, for example, for me when I was doing it. And so this E-structure I was talking about, I start with events before a conference, then take everybody with me, I suppose, introducing all those participants and people back to the conference and move forward. That was the only way I could handle the material and the debate that I wanted. But like I say, I was just very much constrained by what happened when.
Let me just add one. If you want a great model of nonfiction writing, it's not specifically science writing, but it's a book I recommend to everyone who will listen to me. It's John McPhee's Levels of the Game. I don't know, has anybody in this room heard of this book? Excellent. All right. It's an early book by McPhee, and it's ostensibly the story of two guys playing a tennis match, Arthur Ashe and Chuck Graebner. These are names that will ring no bells to almost anyone in this room. I saw both of them play, actually. I'm old enough. It's an astonishing work of nonfiction. It's a brilliant piece of writing. It has all kinds of structural complexity, and it shows how rich a seemingly simple narrative of a tennis match that begins at the beginning and goes to the end, whereas the entire rest of the book is scattered all over time and place and location. It's an extraordinary piece of nonfiction writing. There's a reason John McPhee is sort of exists up on the pantheon of American nonfiction writers. And another exercise, if you want to just stretch your muscles, I sometimes tell people to do this, go to a museum and find a, you know, pre-20th century painting, one that has realistic depiction and some element of narrative in it. And then sit there and outline the different narratives you could make out of that. Just map the picture. I mean, I was at the National Gallery for all of 15 minutes yesterday looking at the Titian exhibit, you know, the little Titian thematic exhibition there with the flight to Egypt. And you can sit there and you can really play with those pictures and you can think about different structures and you can say, do I begin with the digression, the peasant in the background? Do I, you know, what's that bird they're calling an eagle that looks like a raven to me and all this sort of stuff? Or you can go straight to the action. There are all kinds of things. And lastly, there's an old book called Mimesis by a guy named Auerbach. The first chapter of it is on the web in various places, and it talks about the different ways of seeing that are involved in the scene in the Odyssey where Odysseus's servant recognizes him by the wound on his leg from the boar hunt. It's near the end of the Odyssey. And the sacrifice of Isaac scene. It talks about different ways of representing reality, which is what mimesis means, of course. And it's a wonderful way to start thinking about building the world of whatever text you're writing.
Now, I realize it's lunchtime, so if you do want to head out to lunch, please do. But I think we can take maybe one more question, or two more questions maybe, from right at the back. For other good examples of narrative, I think The Big Short by Michael Lewis, who's an American journalist, writing about the subprime crisis. It's not science, but that book is fantastically good at writing about complex things, people, and you'll finish it in 2 days if you start it. It's that good. Please. Can you shout your question? Yeah. Tom, tips. Maybe we can come back to that right at the end. If there's one more question in between, perhaps. Yeah, the front here. Maybe you can just shout your question.
I'll shout.
Yeah.
Sorry to put my front Tom again. I just wondered whether from your somewhat unique position, whether you notice any differences between science journalism in the States and science journalism in the UK, different approaches, different...
Just for people who didn't get that. Differences between science journalism in the US and the UK. And Tom, if you want to do your tips at the end as well.
That's actually a very hard question because I see significant differences between particular publications or individual writers. But I'm not sure it breaks down into national styles. I mean, The New Scientist is a very different kind of magazine than Discover. There's more verve in the writing style in, I think, some of the British approaches to science writing. I think there is, the comparisons are invidious because I could say things that I perceive, but then I realize that I come up with 6 or 7 counterexamples. Ed Young, who's now left the room, so I can embarrass him in absentia, I think is an unmistakably British-sounding voice to my ears, and Carl Zimmer, who is similarly prominent and always referred to in the States, is unmistakably American. And Ed uses a kind of slashing wit more than Carl does, but then you read Carl's just demolition of the whole idea of TED Talks in a publication that Ed and Carl and I all write for called Download the Universe, a plug, it's a new review of ebooks on science. And that could have been written with, you know, slightly different spellings of color and so forth by Ed. So there are strong differences between individuals and publications, but not, I think, as strong anymore on this sort of, you know, national culture.
Can I ask you a quick follow-up? Where do you go first when you're looking for science news? What's your first
I don't have one. I'm a real magpie. But I will tell you that this is one of the places where I really use Twitter. I have a group called Science Writers on my tweet deck, and I add, you know, as people I follow, you know, as I follow new people who are science writers, I'll stick them in that group. And one of the big functions of that is people throw up their blog posts, their stories, their arguments, and that's very often the first place I go in the day, and I will follow chains of argument there. But I actually think it's a big problem for science writing and science journalism generally that we don't have an infrastructure of websites and communication that curates this extraordinary explosion of interesting science writing, and often conversations between different writers and publications. And that's something I'd like to see us as a institutionally develop as a profession or a craft. We're a craft, we're not a profession. We shouldn't, you know, don't. We get our hands dirty, and that's a good thing. Very quickly, tips. I mentioned going to the gallery and working with pictures or photographs, as Manjit did. I'm a serial outliner, and there's a big argument. Do you outline or do you let the material tell you what the story is? And my answer is both. I write the story. I write the outline of the story I'm going to tell before I know anything about it. And with each increment of learning, after each day's research, I re-outline it. I want to try and understand in a systematic way what I've learned. And as I write an outline before I write, and at the end of each day's writing, I outline what I have to do to finish that section. And if it alters the larger outline, I'll work on that. It's a continuous device for formalizing your instinctive knowledge of what's changed in your understanding of your story as you move through the process. And the last thing I do, and this is a real simple-minded tip, and you've all heard it before, at the end of each day's writing on a long-form piece, and this is when you've got 70, 80,000 words to fill and you're looking at months of writing, the problem, not of writer's block writ large, but oh shit, I have to start another day with a blank computer screen and I don't know, you know, and I have to start from scratch, is, you know, you can waste 2 or 3 hours of your prime writing time just trying to think how to get back into it. Write through your transition, whatever it is. If you finished a chapter, write anything of a first paragraph of the next chapter. If you finished a section, write the next, start of the next section. If you're stopping mid-section, write the first sentence of the next paragraph. Whatever it is, force yourself to do it. Then re-outline, as I just said, then have a beer or several.
Okay, well, I think we'll stop there. These guys are going to be here for the rest of the day, so do ask them more questions, including one which I thought you'd all ask, Richard, is how do I get commissioned for New Scientist? So, you know, he's your man for that. But until then, please give a round to Manjit, to Richard, and to Tom.